What brings a community together? Shared insights? Shared conversations? Welcome to Open Door by Cox Communities, tackling the big questions on the minds of smart community business leaders.
Welcome back to Open Door by Cox Communities, a show dedicated to bring you the latest information, hottest trends, and newest technologies for you to consider when making decisions for your multifamily communities. Hi, I'm your host, Valerie Sargent. And today on the show, we're discussing the current economic outlook for 2024 and the impact it's having on the multifamily industry. I'm very happy to say that joining me for the discussion is Jonathan Smoke, Chief Economist at Cox. Welcome, Jonathan. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Valerie, and I'm excited to be here with you.
As chief economist for Cox, you are involved in a wide variety of industries, and I know you have a particular expertise in the auto industry, but you actually began your career in the housing industry. So before we get into our discussion on the current economic outlook and the multifamily industry, I was hoping you would take a few minutes to tell us a little bit about yourself and your career journey and your current role at Cox.
Sure. It may sound cliche, but I think my journey has been pretty unique. I was an economics major back in college, and I really loved both the theoretical and quantitative parts of economics and fundamentally how you could use economics to help understand and explain the world. But I mistakenly thought that the only career in economics would be in academia or maybe in government. And neither of those were very tantalizing to me because I wanted to be where real things happen. So instead of pursuing a PhD, I decided to get an MBA and I landed in management consulting. And management consulting itself can be a bit of an education and an exciting way to learn industries and business dynamics. And of course, fate would have it that early in my consulting career, I landed in housing, working with home builders and commercial real estate companies. And that's really when I started to apply economics to business decisions, because builders and developers and property owners make enormous investments in very specific locations that can often lead to quite varied results that are hugely impacted by economic cycles, interest rates, and other factors that really can be modeled and predicted. So, you know, eventually that then took me to Realtor.com, where I created an economics team and really built out a very high profile position and group studying real estate. And then the opportunity at Cox came along and tempted me to leave housing and try something new in automotive. And so in a sort of roundabout way, I'm now in the happy position to also advise Cox Communications and Cox Enterprises in all of the other areas they are investing. So in a way, I'm back in housing, but the truth is I've continued to follow housing closely. It's in my blood, and it's very natural to sort of have the conversation with you today.
Now, I would be extremely remiss if we didn't talk about one other awesome thing about you, Jonathan, and that is that you are also a DJ. Tell us a little bit about this side of you and the unique way that you use music in your work as an economist. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, for those who believe you're making this up at this point, that is real. My DJ name is DJ Smokey Smoke. I did not choose that name for myself. It was bestowed on me. And the reason that that not only sort of developed and but has become integral to the way that I deliver economics is also a pretty interesting story. I've always loved music. I did some DJing in junior high and high school and then in college. And because I had a pretty extensive collection of music, I found myself DJing family and friends parties, especially if it had an 80s theme. And then my kids started pulling me into doing school dances And I even had some paying gigs along the way. But I'll never forget the moment that I had the epiphany to incorporate music into my economic presentations. It was about 12 years ago, and I was flying across the country and working on a presentation on an airplane while listening to my favorite music on headphones. And I realized that the lyrics of a song that I was listening to exactly matched the economic theme that I was trying to describe and wanted to get across to my audience. So I decided that day to add music to my presentation, and it's been a hallmark of what I've done in economic presentations ever since. And these days, actually, if I try to do a presentation without music, people get really disappointed. So, you know, it works great because no one expects an economist to be entertaining, let alone include music. And economics can sometimes be depressing. So music is a way to make something upbeat, even when it's not. And it's a great way for people to remember the insights that I'm trying to deliver. So it's a staple of what I do, and I'm probably never going to stop doing it.
I love that so much. It's just become part of your brand, and it is a very big part of who you are. I'm excited to share that you have created a special playlist just for our listeners. So thank you for fitting my Foo Fighters in there. I appreciate that. We'll be sure to include a link for our listeners to download your playlist along with our episode details.
And so every song, I put together 20 very eclectic songs from, you know, everything from the Beatles to Lunch Money Lewis, but they all tie to really important things that we're going to be talking about today.
And as much as I would like to talk to you about DJing all day, because I also love music and I like the genres that you're in, let's get into the current state of the economy, because I know everyone listening is excited to get your perspective on things. For the last 2 years, we've been hearing a lot about a looming recession, which never really materialized. What did you make of the speculation, and do you think there is still cause for concern?
So we've been through an unprecedented and challenging time. I know that word unprecedented has been used quite a bit, but boy, when you look at the last 5 years in particular, it has truly been something that was hard to really tie back to history. I mean, we use history as a guide. That's what much of economics is on the quantitative side, is really looking to see how conditions have fared before. And when you're in unprecedented times, it's really tough to say, well, we've never quite seen that before, so we don't know what's going to happen. And so for the better part of the last 2 years, we've fretted specifically about the most anticipated recession that never happened. And thankfully, that never happened. But why it was so anticipated was, well, the Fed was tightening monetary conditions so dramatically and raising rates the most that they ever have in the shortest period of time in 2022 and 2023. In prior circumstances, anything remotely close to that had always led to a recession. And then on top of that, there were numerous leading indicators that economists use to predict when recessions happen. Now, the funny thing about indicators is they're usually wrong. And, you know, some of them reliably predict 9 out of the last 5 recessions and those kinds of numbers. So we knew that this was going to be a tough time to sort of navigate and have high confidence in what would happen next. We were seeing a resilient consumer, and we have great access to timely data on consumer credit card spending. We kept looking for signs that the labor market was deteriorating, and it just wasn't coming through in jobless claims. You know, last year ended up producing over 3 million jobs when at one point the job outlook was for job losses, and that never really occurred. But, you know, we had elevated recession risk because, again, you had the Fed driving up rates, and that was dramatically slowing things down in certain sectors. And housing was really ground zero for where a lot of the negative trends were happening. Thankfully, recession risk is now lower. I would say if we were at 50% this time last year, we're about half of that level of recession. And so I think there's more upside risk, frankly, than downside risk. But we're still skating around thin ice in some areas of the economy. So I continue to keep a very watchful eye on consumer spending. I keep a very watchful eye on the labor market because it's those two things are really the things that separated us from starting to see an economy that moves in the wrong direction.
What are your thoughts on this idea of a quote unquote soft landing? Is that what we're experiencing right now?
So I do think, yeah, that is what we're experiencing. So what does that mean? It basically means slowing growth. And so it paints the picture of the landing you want in an airplane. You're going really fast and really strong, and then you want to touch down on Earth and hopefully make it as soft as possible. What would it be if it wasn't a soft landing? It would be a hard landing or a crash, and either one of those would produce declines in economic activity and job losses. And, you know, as I said, I think we have more upside risks than down. So actually, I would, instead of talking about, is it really, are we destined for either a hard landing or a soft landing? And that's really how the debate started to evolve last year. And increasingly, it is looking like, okay, soft landing won over hard landing. I actually think for 2024, it's more likely a question of, do we have a soft landing or do we have no landing? And no landing basically means that the plane keeps flying. We don't really have meaningfully slowing growth. And right now I'm looking at a GDP forecast for the year that's 2.3%. And we had 2.5% last year. And if you'd told us in March of 2023 that we could have 2.3% or greater, I think everyone would have taken that number. So I'm hopeful that indeed we'll have very little and maybe no landing at all.
Oh, I like that the plane just keeps on cruising. I think that's great.
Hopefully refueled. And,
right, you know, right, no right. You know, there's that tanker that flies beside it and has like the extra fuel.
Yeah.
Well, unlike that looming recession, inflation has been a major problem for the economy. What are you thinking with regard to the current rate of inflation we're seeing as we've been heading into 2024?
So inflation has been our core problem, actually going back to 2021, when Russia invaded Ukraine and things started to turn dramatically in that direction. And what has made it worse in the short term, especially in terms of the economy, is the medicine we had to take in order to bring inflation down. And that medicine is largely what the Fed has been doling out to us. And so it's been especially hard on housing because of the huge increase in interest rates we've seen since 2021, when, you know, at the end of 21, we had the lowest rates we've ever had for mortgages and many types of consumer and business loans. You know, and as I mentioned earlier, the Fed since then has raised rates faster than they ever had in a short period of time. Well, thankfully, inflation has come down. The latest CPI reading that we had for January says we were down to 2.9% year over year. But if you saw the news, even though the year over year number was coming down and is now under 3%, we saw an accelerating increase in the monthly change.
Right.
That was happening. So a lot of people were concerned. I wouldn't put a whole lot of stock or worry in that. We know it's not going to be a straight line down. Plus, January is one of the months of the year that's particularly tricky to collect data and apply seasonal adjustments that give us a true sort of meaningful look. The Fed also looks at another measure called the PCE, the personal consumption expenditures. It's basically another basket of another way to look at spending in the economy. There are some differences between the CPI and PCE in terms of what's in them and what they're measuring. The CPI, I think, is really the one we should pay the most attention to because it's more true to what typical consumers experience. And it's also faster. We always get it in the second week of the month, and whereas PCE comes in the last week of the month. So there are a lot more things that people pay attention to CPI, but much of the CPI feeds into the PCE. At the end of the day, it's not that difficult to predict and figure out what PCE is going to look like. Well, bottom line is the Fed wants to see us get to roughly a 2% year over year level of inflation. And that's more in their PCE measure, which in the CPI, it would typically be about a half a percentage point higher. So we're close. We are a half a percentage point to a full percentage point away from being at their target. And thankfully, as it's been coming down, well, let me explain where we hit. Sorry, in June of 2022, we were at the worst level of inflation, and that was 9% in the CPI. And that sounds really bad, and it's much better to be at under 3% today. But if you actually then look at how different income groups experience inflation, we don't experience inflation in the same way. Because if you look at our budgets and how we spend our incomes, lower income households are going to be spending far more of their monthly budget on food, energy, and shelter. And that's precisely where this particular inflation that we went through was most significant, especially back in June of 22. So when CPI was 9% for the headline number or what the typical American consumer was experiencing in June of 22, the lowest income quintile, so households making under $30,000 per year, experienced 22% inflation.
Wow.
So that really helps to that knowledge of understanding how inflation has been even more severe for certain demographics.
And the people who would not need it are the ones who are experiencing the most of it. And you know what? You raise a good point, because there have been some positive developments with regard to wage growth. But how does that stack up when compared to the inflation actually being experienced?
So exactly. There's two sides of almost every coin of this story that we've gone through. And so, yes, high income households have been in a much better shape. Frankly, they're also the ones who tend to own homes, who have locked in mortgages under 3%, that are literally in the best financial shape of their lives. And they're experiencing today less than 3% inflation. So there is no inflation problem for those households. Thankfully, the labor market has been really the tale of the service level. The hourly worker has had even more of an upper hand. Because if you think about it, as the economy shut down for the pandemic, it was those frontline workers that were most disrupted immediately. That's where all the jobs were lost. But that was also where, as the economy not only kind of powered forward as businesses reopened, it was really getting those people back to work that became most challenging. And a lot of people had more career opportunities. We went from having historically what is less than one open job per person that's unemployed. We have been solidly above one and actually closer to two at the tightest part of the job market. So the hourly worker has experienced the most wage inflation, and that has helped to offset. Unfortunately, the government doesn't produce quite the same level of detail that lets me tell you precisely like how it lines up. But the aggregate data that they do produce every month basically tells us we had a period of time in 2021 and all of 2022 and into the first quarter of 2023, that inflation was higher than wage and income growth. So that basically meant that until about this time last year, most workers and households were finding themselves falling behind each and every month, even though they were employed, even though they were seeing really strong wage growth.
They just couldn't keep up.
Yeah, that's right. But inflation turned the corner around April of last year and has continued to trend down, while wage growth has only come down slightly and is still very strong by historical standards. So the analogy to me is we have threaded the needle, and because the forecasts for the economy are for the labor market to remain strong and just cool a little bit while inflation comes down another half to full percentage point further, it means the consumer's financial situation should improve, and that therefore it's at least a soft landing.
That's encouraging. I think another big factor impacting the economy is that interest rates remain high. And I know this because I'm buying a car right now, and my credit card also sent me a notice that my interest rate is going up. So how is this impacting things coming into 2024? And do you have any expectation that we could see them coming down in the coming months, pretty please?
So yes, that's been the nasty medicine. And as we've started 2024, it was looking like actually interest rates were coming down because they came down in December, but we've gone in the wrong direction so far in 2024. fact, if you're buying a used car right now, I hate to tell you that we actually have seen the highest interest rates in 24 years in February.
It's not a good time to have to buy a car, but I had to buy a car.
Well, and that's an important point. There are often people who have to do things regardless of what the sort of economic environment is. So those high rates, we saw basically from the lowest of lows at the end of 21 to the highs of roughly where we are today, mortgage rates have gone up by about 5 percentage points. Used car rates have gone up by about 6 percentage points. New car rates are closer to mortgages, up by about 5 percentage points. And that has an amplifying effect on the inflation that monthly payments experience. Because, and by the way, monthly payments are also influenced by the price of the good, which in the case of homes and cars have both experienced pretty substantial inflation as well. So we have seen consumers really priced out of the market because of the combination of high prices and high rates, plus inflation reducing their buying power. Like in the case of median and lower income households, they have to have a place to live. Rents are going up, so they have to spend more on housing. That means they have to pull back in other areas, maybe choose a used car when forced to buy a vehicle rather than buying a new vehicle. It definitely slows the economy. And so the Fed's efforts to drive up rates, rates are higher than what is collectively viewed as what the natural level of rates are. There's some debate exactly what that is, but basically it revolves around a number that's probably less than 3% or at most 3% for the Fed funds. And yet we're at 5.25 to 5.5. So that tells us that the Fed should be starting to reduce rates, or else the economy just can't keep up with the amazing sort of threading the needle that we've experienced, you know, over the last 2 years with rates moving higher and now at this high. So rates have definitely taken a toll, slowed housing dramatically, kind of locked up the existing home market, have driven costs higher for businesses and consumers alike. We definitely see it having a negative impact in the multifamily market because it impacts multifamily investment. So we've seen big pullback in permits and starts, which are the leading parts of new construction. It's also cut dramatically on transactions that are taking place in the market.
Just as a segue, that raises a good point that during the pandemic, we all saw the price of building materials skyrocket as a result of a variety of supply chain issues. What are your thoughts on the resolution of these issues in the years ahead?
Yes, we experienced substantial material shortages across most industries because they had to do with this sort of unique circumstances, the way that COVID was disrupting transportation and impacting production. The vehicle market was actually ground zero for a lot of that kind of material shortages that were occurring. And the good news is that most material shortages have ended. There's still some portions of electronics and particular goods that go into construction that are still a little bit tough to get and experiencing higher inflation. But overall, especially relative to where we've been, it's as close to normal as we've seen.
Yeah, and I know from the broadband perspective, there were a lot of distributors who had overordered products. So now they have too many of those things available, and their supply chain is a little bit different than it was as well.
Yes, exactly. We saw people overordering that built up inventories that actually induced what was recalled as a freight recession last year. So there are parts of the transportation like trucks on the road that have experienced tremendous declines in both activity and the kind of price of transportation. But everything sort of points to most supply chains are normalizing, and certainly the abnormal period we went through is largely behind us. Not to say that something new can't happen. We obviously have some challenges in the Middle East. In particular, the Red Sea has been disruptive to some goods that naturally flow between Asia and Europe. Thankfully, that doesn't impact the U.S. too much because most of our goods are coming from other regions and we're really not susceptible. But a lot of oil moves through that part of the region. And if the price of diesel and gasoline goes up, that tends to drive up a lot of costs and impacts manufacturing and construction like. But so far, we're not really seeing the situation globally turn into any more problems. So I think most of the supply issues are behind us. We still have lingering labor issues, though. And that relates to a theme that I think people need to think of as kind of either two sides of the same coin, or maybe the right analogy is a two-edged sword. Because on the one hand, we want the consumer to have strong wage and earnings growth to be able to continue to spend and be in healthy financial condition, to move, to take out a new lease, to buy a new vehicle, to do all of those things they do in good circumstances. But on the other hand, we don't want it to be so strong that it drives inflation and causes businesses to have to raise prices too much that keeps the inflation story going. But labor is something that I think is going to be driven to favor the consumer and the worker for the foreseeable future simply because of demographics. We are seeing the boomers retire, and there aren't enough of younger people to completely fill those open spots.
Something else I would love to get your thoughts on is how insurance needs are impacting the housing industry and the U.S. economy. Because I know, like, especially here in California and in Florida, I've seen a lot of issues around insurance. And when I've been talking to multifamily owners and operators, that's something that they're bringing up a lot to me. So what are your biggest takeaways there?
Yeah, well, my takeaway is, unfortunately, that insurance is a big challenge. It is not easy to measure and quantify, and it's not easy to point to an easy solution to the situation we find ourselves in.
A lot of companies have been pulling out of some of these markets.
Yeah, and I think that sort of creates a bit of a crisis that hopefully eventually leads to a solution. But I can share a couple of data points that the team has been able to put together. Well, one, the government tracks auto insurance very closely. Why they track auto insurance more than property insurance, I'm not really certain. I'm really curious as to why it's much easier to quantify inflation. But auto insurance was up 21% year over year in January. So if you're buying a new car, I highly suggest checking what your insurance is.
I have recently. And yeah, it's higher.
Yeah. So that impacts affordability, because historically, insurance is about 1/8 of a household's transportation budget. So if that is going up 21% year over year, even if the other things are just experiencing normal inflation, it's really going to hurt your budget. Well, interestingly, the data in the property market, and I think I got a third quarter number from Yardi Matrix, said that apartment companies were reporting a roughly 20% increase year over year. So it seems like the same level of inflation that we're observing in auto is happening in housing.
Yeah. And then, of course, they have to cover their costs. And then you see those things reflected in rental rates and things like that as well.
Yeah. And you were pointing out, you know, some of this is very, even more significant in specific states like Florida and California. And obviously, costs can vary dramatically and have been escalating, but some of it is related to climate change and the fact that more losses are being experienced. But I also, you know, my instinct is this is one of those industries that is regulated, and we sort of have a special form of regulation in the U.S. And to me, it reminds me a lot of healthcare that, you know, basically, folks, this ain't working, and we've got some real issues. I have some family that I know are experiencing today in Florida that their property insurance now costs more than their mortgage.
Wow, really?
That makes zero sense.
That blows my mind.
And is not sustainable. Yeah. So there is no easy solution. Hopefully, what we're going to see is that the inflation we've seen happen in both property and auto insurance is really a lagged effect to the price and material cost increases that we experienced 1 and 2 years ago. So hopefully the 20% number is a peak and we start to see it come down. But frankly, I think it's also an indication that the insurance and the way that we approach regulating it also needs a hard rethink, because it's just not tenable.
Let's focus a bit more on how these economic conditions are impacting the housing sector, and in particular, of course, the multifamily industry. What are some of the biggest ways high interest rates and inflation are impacting the industry?
So focusing on the consumer. The consumer is why we do what we do, and the consumer is responsible for about 70% of the U.S. economy. Housing is the biggest and most important part of any household's budget. If you look at after-tax disposable income, housing is about 35% of the typical household's expenses, and that's including rent and utilities and some other things that all add up to that. But if you look at, again, the picture I was painting earlier of lower income consumers, it's close to 50% or more of their household budget. So we know that housing is not getting cheaper because demand continues to exceed supply. This is a function of land and availability and the fact that our economy keeps growing and our population is growing and households are growing. We do think that we have relief coming. Particularly where that relief is coming has been in rent. It hasn't been fully reflected across the board in like the CPI data. Some of that is a measurement issue by the way that the government tracks rents on more of a rolling basis as opposed to what new rents are seeing. But we know in the market level data that asking rents are still positive, but they're barely positive. Yardi's numbers put asking rents at growing just 1.6% last year. And we're seeing huge differences by market. There are markets that have seen the bulk of the new supply coming on, impacting and producing negative trends. So there are places like Las Vegas, Boise, Idaho, Phoenix, Austin. Ironically, all of the places with the strongest growth are the places where there's the most rent pressure. And you have places in the Northeast and Midwest that didn't see quite the same investment in new apartments started a couple of years ago that aren't seeing those kinds of declines and instead are seeing increases. And then the age-old college towns appear to be navigating this without much change. But it basically says that the worst of the inflation, at least in the near term, is over. And it's consistent with our view of that we were having earlier of threading the needle, the soft landing, inflation comes down, enabling the Fed to start cutting rates. And it's really when those rates start being cut down, you can start to see people moving into home ownership more easily and doing other things that then kind of take on more of a virtuous cycle in the economy.
When you look at renters as opposed to homeowners, are you seeing any major difference between the way current conditions are impacting these two different groups? I know I had to move twice last year as a renter, and I had a little bit of sticker shock for sure. Are you seeing anything with the differences in the groups, renters versus homeowners?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Inflation has been worse for renters. Renters tend to be median and lower income groups because they substantially represent what I think the industry sometimes referred to as renters by necessity. And as a result, the trends that I were talking about, they disproportionately spend more of their budgets on food, energy, and shelter. But with rates coming down, with rents coming down, with energy no longer going up, and hopefully with insurance and some other things coming down, it would suggest that they have the most to gain. And by the way, it leaves them still in a commanding position in the labor market because the demographic story is not turning negative in terms of the competition. We have 1.4 open positions for every unemployed person, and businesses are going to have to compete for the foreseeable future in keeping employees. And there's a lot of huge potential. I would argue one of construction's biggest challenges is encouraging young people to go into the trades. These are good ways to make a living and to enjoy very strong income, be very tied to your community. And as a result, you can contribute to sort of the positive sort of housing market. So I think we're going to navigate this. I am optimistic about it. Yes, there are things like insurance that worry me and are troublesome. But I think all in all, if we navigate the next couple of months, we're definitely going to be moving towards more positive trends in the years to come.
When it comes to the current housing market all across the country, the affordability of housing has become a major topic. So looking ahead, what are your thoughts on the longevity of this trend?
Well, I think, you know, ironically, in the short term, what higher rates have done has actually caused new construction to slow down. And that's sort of the opposite of what we really need to address the fact that we fundamentally have underbuilt for 15 years. So thankfully, as that starts to turn, we think new construction has bottomed. Most of the growth that's been happening in the near term is in single family, but we need that. And thankfully, that single family is tilting more towards lower price, more affordable product that will encourage people that are trying to start the climbing the property ladder will be able to. So some of this will happen because of what's being delivered. The short-term negative impact on rents will help resolve some of the issues. But longer term, what are the factors that contribute to this? It's sort of like the insurance or the healthcare analogy. It's not one thing, it's many things. And it is not easy to find, what is the government entity that can solve this. So we've got the ongoing housing shortage, so we need to encourage more. What is blocking that? Zoning, the lack of financing, and the lack of particularly programs like low-income tax credits that help to direct more investment towards more affordable housing. Clearly, we've got land constraints in some places, but really it's the horrible combination of how zoning and NIMBYism essentially prevents density from being developed when that's the right solution for everybody, and including the people who are already there, because you won't have a continuing to grow economy if you can't expand your labor force and take care of the people who are going to be a part of that growth that's happening. I think the pieces that I also am concerned about are labor. As I shared, we've got to encourage people in the trades. But I think creating the framework and creating the way that, say, low-income tax credits are more easily delivered and giving encouragement around areas that are having more success in promoting the zoning and the sort of density rule changes that help to produce more housing will be better over the longer term.
It's no secret that there is a presidential election approaching. So I'd love to get your thoughts on any other impacts that you see this could have on the economy in 2024 and beyond. What do you think?
Well, it is an election year, and I'm not too worried about the election year itself having a negative impact on the economy. I like to joke that no one decides where they're going to live based on who they think is going to be in the White House. We have some big fiscal challenges facing us. And so what I'm worried about is what happens in 2025, because that's the year we have to tackle a debt ceiling. We kick the can down the road to January of 2025 on that. We've got affordable health care funding that expires in the first quarter of that year. We've got expiration of the Tax Cuts and Job Act tax policy that was enacted in 2018 that expires next year. And we have a rapidly rising federal deficit that will soon, unfortunately, cost us more to service our debt as the government than we spend on defense. And it makes me a little bit more pessimistic about 2025 and what happens next. And thinking that, well, housing, it probably once again is not going to be front and center. So I guess the good news is I've sounded optimistic today. I'm not so worried about the immediate future, but I am concerned that we aren't doing the things that are necessary for the good of the country and specifically for housing.
When it comes to younger generations that we were talking about earlier, getting into the housing market and buying their first home, what are some of the biggest challenges the economy is presenting to them right now?
So younger people are most likely to be median and low income. So the earlier discussion about who's experiencing the worst inflation has been negatively impacting them the most. They also have had limited ability to build credit because of the tremendous move up in interest rates, keeping them on the sidelines for vehicle purchases, using their credit cards more, you name it. And most importantly, build up savings to climb the ownership ladder because, even before 10 years ago, the biggest issue for a young person was not qualifying from a payment perspective. It was coming up with the specific down payment that they needed. And obviously, with the inflation that we've seen and with underwriting or mortgages being even more conservative today, that's even harder. They're also the people that hold the most student debt, and that is limiting. So it's clearly challenging. But let me end on a positive note on this topic. The labor market is in their favor. And, I have two kids that are Gen Z kids. And what I'm observing for many of them and it seems to be a characteristic of the generation overall, is they're very disciplined financially. They are obviously clearly well educated. And so I'm optimistic that the kids will all be okay eventually.
I think they say that about every generation, right?
Well, it's funny because, you know, when I was initially in housing and at realtor.com, the popular theme coming out of the Great Recession was that millennials would never want to own homes. And we were like, so that is so wrong. As soon as they start getting married and having children, they're going to want to have homes. And they indeed are the highest cohort. So I'm optimistic. We're going to navigate these challenges. These are short-term things that in a few years are largely going to be behind us. And in fact, they may be the ones who step up when the old people get out of the room and find the big solutions to the big problems that we face, like insurance and climate change and affordable housing. So even though it looks dire today, they may be the ones that usher in the better tomorrow.
Well, affordable housing, obviously, when it comes to housing, there's a lot of government policy at all different levels, from local all the way to federal. And there has been a lot of talk about various rent control policies recently. What are your thoughts on the impact of these types of laws that they have on the housing industry? Are there any better options or programs out there?
So the free market doesn't always work correctly, but also the regulations that we try to apply to fix some of the issues over time can lead to unintended consequences. And so, like our discussion about insurance, I think the government approaches we've had to fix housing so far have had, at best, mixed outcomes. And so, unfortunately, there's no easy answer. It really takes continuing to experiment. I love the idea of finding things that are working in certain parts of the country and figuring out, can we replicate those in other areas? Focusing on low income, you know, high on my list would be continuing to have a robust program for producing low income tax credits and adjusting zoning and helping people realize how counterproductive it is to have some of the rules that for well-intended purposes can actually make the cost of development or development at all being impossible to do when it's absolutely needed to help address the lack of housing that we have today.
Well, I think that's the whole point, right? Like, while regulations are often well-intentioned in many ways, they can sometimes have those negative impact and those unintended consequences, especially in the space of affordable housing. So what are some of the things you have observed that impact the industry's ability or desire to build more affordable housing when these types of regulations have been put into place?
Well, I definitely think part of it is a tone. So it's moving away from NIMBYism and actually looking for it's YIMBYism, yes, in my backyard, deliberately encouraging those sort of changes and getting the grassroots support. And I do think you have some very progressive parts of the country, like in Oregon, and even where I live in Atlanta, I live in probably one of the most progressive parts of Atlanta, Decatur, that has been really thinking more positively about what is it going to take in order to invest and have real production of affordable housing. So I think it's not so much about the federal government, even though, you know, I've been hyping the presidential election and all. The federal government, what we want them to do is to establish fiscal and monetary conditions that keep the economy healthy, keep interest rates as low as they should be, and therefore investment attractive, then focus all of our attention more at the state and local level, which is really where the rubber hits the road.
And I think educating those groups that are well-intended, like letting them know what some of those consequences are that happen. And really the communication between both of those groups is so important to work together to find a solution. As we wrap up things today here, Jonathan, I wanted to give you a moment to leave the audience with a bit of parting advice. What is the most important thing you want them to take away from our conversation today?
I'm not sure that I can just say one thing. So let me give you three things that come to mind. One is that what you do is vital. And yes, we may have record new supply coming online in the short term, presenting more pressure on rents and higher concessions in some markets. The fundamentals suggest that a challenging 2024 is going to give way to normalizing demand that looks very strong for the future and is vitally important for our economy and the future of the country. So thank you for what you do. Stay positive. Two, we've spent this time talking about national trends, but here's the real kind of essence of what I think people need to be paying attention to. There is no such thing as a U.S. housing market. We are made up of thousands of housing markets. So pay attention to your own backyard and some of the challenges that we were talking about. And then finally, as we started, let's put a little music in your life as well. And you can start with the playlist that I put together.
Definitely. I know I pick up my new car today. So I'm going to listen to your playlist in my new car today, Jonathan. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan. We had a wonderful time with you today, and I appreciate you being here. I learned so much. I'm not an economist. And so thank you for opening my mind and helping me see things a little bit differently. I appreciate your time today.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you, and good luck with that new car.
Thank you so much. Thanks again to Jonathan for being on the show today and discussing the current economic outlook and its impact on the multifamily industry. And if you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and leave us a review. Thanks again for listening. I'm Valerie Sargent, and this has been Open Door, brought to you by Cox Communities.